For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
If you haven't been here in a while, just want you to know that tonight we're talking about sex again. So, hope you're looking forward to that. We've been studying 1 Corinthians, and really the whole kind of theme that drives 1 Corinthians is how God in His grace restores sanity and order to chaos, and moral chaos, spiritual chaos, the chaos of a whole community of people that are really, in a lot of ways, up on blocks. And I think it's pretty awesome to think about the fact that God does want to work not only in our lives as individuals, but He wants to transform us as a community, because He works through us in the context of community, both in terms of getting that message out about the reconciling work of Christ to the world, and also it is within a healthy community that God really does that work of healing and restoring the brokenness that is our lives. So I love this book because it's so real. It gets into the things that we are all, in one way or another, really dealing with. And I don't think there's anything that could be more personally relevant than Paul's discussion, as we've been kind of tracing this through in 1 Corinthians 6 and 7, relating to our sexual identity. All right, tonight, there we go. We're going to talk about sex and the single. We're going to talk about divorce, and we're going to talk about it in the terms that Paul frames them in, and honesty and sensitivity about very deeply personal things. Things that we have all been touched by significantly, and which continue for many of us to have their influence in our lives. And so we want to understand this whole area of sexuality and its breadth, and in the terms that Paul talks about it here in 1 Corinthians. We talked last time about sex within the context of marriage. We made the point that the biblical view of sex is very high, that there's an almost sacredness to the marriage commitment and sex within that relationship, which is a total giving of a whole person to another whole person. And so it's within the framework of a committed, permanent love relationship within a marriage that we are able to give all of who we are, our body, our psychological connection, our emotional connection to that other person, and form that oneness that God intended for us. And so it's a real high reward relationship. Sex is very highly rewarding. It's also high risk. Why? Because it requires this level of vulnerability to the other. And on what basis then can I be completely open and vulnerable to you? What enables me to trust you? Well, in the biblical framework, we have the ability to trust because our identity and our security rests not in our partner, in our spouse, but rather in God Himself. And that then enables us to be givers in the relationship and not dependent on that other person to give to us. And in that way, in the biblical frame of understanding marriage, this is where safe sex is practiced. Now, tonight we want to talk about a continuous discussion about sexuality in relation to being single and issues relating to divorce. And we're just going to take them, as Paul does, in sort of a point-by-point way, because he begins this chapter by saying, now concerning the things about which you wrote. And so throughout this whole section of Paul's letter, chapters 7, really through into 12, Paul is responding to very specific questions that are being asked of him. And so in that context, he says in verse 7, I wish that everyone were single just like I am. But God gives to some the gift of marriage and to others the gift of singleness. So I say to those who aren't married and to widows, and it's very likely that Paul himself was a widower, it is better to stay unmarried just as I am. But if they do not practice self-control, they should go ahead and get married. It's better to marry than to burn with passion. That's probably an expression many of us have heard before. Better to marry than to burn. Well, we need to unpack that a little bit and figure out what it is that Paul is saying. This is his word to the singles, and there's a context for it, and that context is very important. This is situational advice that Paul is giving. There are some things, and he's distinguishing throughout chapter 7, the things that the Lord has said that are true for all. And then there are other things about which the Lord has not spoken, and that these are areas of discernment and of wise decision-making on the part of God's people. And so he begins this discussion of singleness by saying, I wish that you were all like me, namely single. And so he's not saying that's God's will for anybody. Of course not. But he's saying that just from given a number of considerations, that's a good place to be. In view, he says, of the present distress. And so there was all this confusion going on in the Corinthian church that had to deal with the issue of sex. And we were discussing this last time and the week before as well. How people in this group were saying basically, within their marriages, they were saying, well, you know, to be really spiritual is to avoid indulging in the pleasures of the flesh. And apparently the argument has been made, at least I think it's fairly convincing, that mostly this was coming from wives. And a lot of the husbands were responding by saying, that's easy for you to say. And there was this tension, and the tension is reaching a level that men were actually leaving their marriages. They were going to prostitutes. And just we had a whole situation on our hands. And Paul is trying to speak not just to the particulars about sexual morality, but also trying to speak to our whole understanding about sexuality and about the relationship of the body to the spirit. And that's what makes, I think, this whole discussion so important. But he's saying, before we make really important life-defining decisions, we need to chill. We need to not make those decisions in light of this present distress until we get the level of understanding that we really need about this. We know that this is situational advice as well because in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 14, as Paul is writing to the Ephesian church, a different group altogether, in dealing with the problem of widows and single people in that group, Paul says, man, these people should go get married. That's a much better situation for them. They should get married. And so, you know, he's saying here, it's my advice that you ought to remain single just like I am. To the other group, he says, no, man, go get married. And again, this just highlights the significance of the crisis that was being faced by this group. Now, there are things in this passage that are important in terms of positive values of living single. That Paul wants us to understand that a single life is not a plan B life. And that there is dignity and value and virtue in being single, just as there is dignity, value, and virtue in being married. And there are a couple things that he points out. First, that for the single person, the highest value of Christian living is our capacity to serve. We're servants of the Lord. And he's saying that as servants of Christ, a single person has a distinct advantage. And he says this in verses 32 to 34. He says, I want you to be free from the concern of this life. An unmarried man can spend his time doing the Lord's work and thinking about how to please him. But a married man has to also think about earthly responsibilities and how to please his wife. He says, this guy's interests are divided. Now, that's not necessarily an unholy division or anything like that. Of course. But he's simply saying that there is an advantage that single people have, that they are more free to make decisions that put them in a place to serve Christ more effectively with their lives. And I know lots of single folks, and I know a lot of single folks even here tonight. And I know that many of us as single people have made really significant life decisions that you were able to make because you weren't married. The ability, for instance, to walk away from careers that were both high pay and high demand because of the value you placed upon on being available to God to serve His kingdom. And that's a much more difficult decision when you're thinking about kids going to college and all those concerns that you have. When those concerns are off the table, people can make more courageous decisions to make themselves available to be servants of Christ. I've seen this in many cases. Mark Lindbergh's here tonight, I think, or maybe, yeah, there he is. You know, just your ability to quit your job and to move down onto the near west side and get involved with Youth for Christ down there. You know, that's a decision you can make. And it would be a harder decision to make with a family and the responsibilities that come with that. That's a super awesome thing. That is something that we need to extol and say, all right, that's not plan B living. That's awesome. And so many other examples that are exactly like that. And Paul says there's a virtue in being single. There's a second thing that plays to the life of the single person in verses 29 to 31, which is the fear, the freedom of the fear for your family in the times of distress that Paul himself was envisioning for this church. And you know that by the first century, mid-first century, as the church had been established in the Roman Empire, that Roman and Jewish opposition to Christianity was very quick in coming. That persecutions of the church occurred at an informal and regional level almost from the very beginning, as the book of Acts will demonstrate. And then by the mid-60s, A.D. under the reign of Nero, it would take on official Roman policy. Paul is very concerned about people making marriage decisions that would not only affect them, but would affect their spouse and would affect potential children that were coming into that situation. And so he says the remaining time is very short. Those with wives should live, should focus not only on their marriage, and those using the things of the world should not become attached to them, because the clamp is coming down. And there is this concern that Paul has that it's going to be a lot harder to make decisions as these people did do. And the Christians of the first and second centuries, we have historical records of this from Tacitus and other Roman sources. These are men and women brought before local magistrates, called upon to renounce the lordship of Jesus Christ, and in their refusal to do so, were summarily taken out and executed. Men, women, and children. And these were very difficult times. And Paul is saying in the light of what he is seeing there brewing in Corinth, he's saying, there's an advantage to being single. Because to stand up there and to make a decision that will affect your life is a different kind of decision than standing up in front of somebody to make a decision that will affect the lives of your children. You see what I'm saying? So there's sobriety about this, and Paul is saying there's an advantage in this context. Now, let's just probe our understanding of this a little bit further, because I want to talk a little bit about the unique tensions in single life, and I want to think about this with you from three points of view. The first being the challenge of sex and our identity with the single person. And there is no doubt that we live in a society that in some ways even measures our value by our sexual desirability. That value is attached to you based upon how you look and how attractive people find you on that sexual level. Psychologically and emotionally, we have inbred needs for it to be acceptable, to be wanted. And in a culture like ours that is so bereft of the things that really matter and focus on the physical, being desired, being wanted, being acceptable is defined profoundly in sexual terms. And so we have just this whole value system that promotes this. And people who are single and people who are trying to make a principled stand in their own sexual lives as single Christians find themselves fighting a torrent of values, and that doesn't just affect, you know, how do I think about these things, but really in a very conscious way is eating away at questions like, am I acceptable? Am I desirable if I'm not being desired? And we have to understand the enormous tension that produces and how to think about that in a way that enables us to put in perspective the pressures that we really do face as single people. And to that end, I think that we can be helped very much by my friend Paco. Paco and his wife, Sarah, work in Johnstown, Ohio, among young people, almost all singles, for working through Youth for Christ. It's an awesome ministry. They're reaching a part of that population out there that churches are not reaching, that no other organization is. We're really thrilled to be able to have a partnership with them. We got a couple tables, in fact, with our Johnstown folks even here tonight. So we ought to just acknowledge that they're here. Stand up and take a bow. Reluctantly, but you're not moving. What's wrong with you, Rebecca? Staying put. Okay, we got two tables, but only one bold enough to come up. All right. Anyway, I think Paco's got a lot to offer us by way of thought about this, and I want to just introduce this thought that we should listen to his counsel in this important area. So why don't you come on up, Paco,
sure.
And
Mom,
regale us with your wisdom.
We've got 5 minutes.
That's right, and I'm going to be right here.
Right. I am Paco. I am one of the volunteers with the Johnstown Campus Life Program. We do a number of programs and Bible studies with middle school, high school teenagers. And one of the programs we do is a seminar called How to Avoid Falling for a Jerk. So we've got a slide. It's an eight-hour presentation, and I'm just going to show you guys just one of the...
There you go.
Great. Thank you. This is the relational attachment model. And it lays out very clearly and very easy to see the way a healthy relationship develops. You've got 5 columns. The first one is how well you know someone. What you know about somebody involves what you know about their personality, their preferences, likes, dislikes, personal history, how they're going to react in any given situation. Beliefs, values, everything there is to know about someone falls under this category. And the next one, well, I want to say a little bit more about know. The only way to develop knowing someone is by being intentional and over time. It doesn't matter how well or how easily you click with somebody, you get along, you have a great time. You cannot know someone in a week. You cannot know someone really in 3 months. You need to be relationally side by side with them over a period of time to know how they're going to react in any given situation and who they really are. The second column is trust. This is your opinion of someone, your gut reaction, kind of how confident you feel about what you believe about them. They seem like a nice person. I like them. I get along well with them. I trust them. Third column is relying on someone. This takes the feeling you have about them and then the actions you actually place. What you do and what you depend upon them with what you value. I trust you with my feelings. I trust you if I tell you a secret, you're not going to betray it. I trust you with my stuff. I'm going to let you borrow a tool and I expect to get it back, you know, in a reasonable condition. Commitment is how much of yourself you give over to the other person in the relationship. And we live in a culture where commitment is scary, and it's a really big deal, and it should be. And then touch is affection and that sexual intimacy that you have with another person in the context of this relationship. Now, you've got these little sliding bars here, and we when you do the seminar, you get this handy-dandy little card with magnets. But a healthy relationship shows that you should not trust anyone any more than you know them. You shouldn't rely on them any more than you think they're trustworthy. You shouldn't commit to anyone more than you're willing to rely on them. And the physical aspect of the relationship shouldn't be any higher than everything else on here. Give you a scenario. You meet a new couple at home church. They come that night. You sit down, you talk with the guy, he seems really nice, you hit it off well, his wife seems like a really great person. Over the span of a week, you invite them over to your house for dinner, they take you out to eat at a restaurant, and then it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he calls you up and he says, "Hey, we just moved in from Connecticut, you know all that. Well, Grandma, back in Connecticut, Grandma's sick. And so we're having some car problems. I wanted to know, can I borrow your car and about $1,000? And I'm going to be gone for about a week or so because I got to go take care of sick grandma. And my wife and I will make it up to you by babysitting your kids sometime when you're out of town." Okay? I'd like to think with this example, it's a no-brainer that I know you for a week and I don't really know you. You wouldn't really rely on somebody with the things that you value, such as your children, your money, your car. So if that seems like a no-brainer, how much more is it to rely on somebody with your heart, with the natural desire people have for relational intimacy with other people? It's not something you want to mess around with. And so much of our culture goes into relationships with trust. You know, touch goes up here, and you may have a pretty good feeling about them, but you know them there. You really rely on them only a little bit, and commitment is next to nothing. And when you lay it out in a visual model like this, it makes sense that to go up here and there and down here, this just doesn't, it's a no-brainer. This doesn't work, and yet people do this all the time. So. Relational attachment model. There you go.
Okay. Well, there you have it. So here's why this matters. This matters because, I hate to say it, but we're not all that rational when it comes to things like this. Right? Am I right? Of course I'm right. This is very emotional. This is, well, more than emotional. It's like being driven by our hormones. And our ability as human beings not to be animals is that we can actually assess the drives that we have and make decisions about them, however difficult they may be, for the sake of our own good and our own health, and being able to just kind of look at things like Paco has described is extremely important. And we need to have categories and labels and understand, yes, you know, what the world tells me is that if I avail myself of touch, ladies especially, then that guy is going to be really interested or potentially interested in commitment. And then I can really rely on him and learn to trust him and get to know him. You see what I'm saying? We got it completely backwards. That's why people are really wounding themselves deeply in this area. And so to be able to think about this a little bit analytically, to have this understanding in our minds so that we can assess what our body is luring us toward and make decisions about that are going to be healthy and help us to move through a situation into a perspective that's going to give life. And I just feel like this is so very, very important, and it's worth our reflections on this. It's worth our understanding this, and that is the way that we move from health, to know someone all the way through touch, rooted in this kind of description. Very healthy, and I appreciate the opportunity to think about that with you. Secondly, in terms of the unique tensions of single life, there is this concern about finding, you know, Mr. or Mrs. Right. Mr. Goodbar, as the movie was back in the 70s. Bad idea. And so we think, if I just find the right person, well, then things are going to work out for me. And of course, we realize, those of us who are married and got married under that illusion, oh man, there's no such thing as the right person. What I need to be focused on is not finding the right person, but being the right person. That's what I need to really be about is God, what kind of person are you shaping me into? Not as a person who's dependent upon that other person to complete me or to make me something that I lack, but you have made me a whole person new in you. And as such, as those opportunities become available, yes, I can pursue partnership with another person, but not because I must have them to be something that I'm not, but rather to share something that I already have. And that difference there is extremely important. And third, there is, I think, often in our thinking in this area, which runs so deep for so many of us, a tendency for disappointment in this area to kind of drift into legalism, a legalistic kind of understanding of ourselves and of God. And so we might be saying to ourselves, if God really cared, he would provide for me a spouse. What are we saying here? If God is a good God, he owes me this thing. And really? Is that right? So God gives good things, that's true, but does God owe me a wife or a husband? And if that becomes sort of the expectation that's embedded deeply into our heart, then we, in a short period of time, find ourselves with a bit of a rift with God, that a sense of disappointment that we have in our hearts, a sense of loneliness perhaps that we have, is now being projected upon God somehow as the source and as the cause of that loneliness. And that is a desperate problem that sometimes single people have. Or in a different direction, some of us may be feeling that not having a spouse is really God's punishment on me. Because why? Because maybe I was sexually immoral earlier in life. And he's like, you burnt that bridge and now I'm going to punish you, or this type of thing. And some people really indulge this kind of thinking. Other people don't, but nonetheless it affects them. And I think it's just really important to kind of bring those accusations from the subterranean depths of our subconscious right into the light and to say, that's not God's way. And that's not who God is. And God does not have a plan B for you as a single person. God has a plan for your life as a person, whether you're married or you are unmarried. And then finally, just that it seems to me that we who are married really need to find ways of serving our single brothers and sisters in the community of Christ. And that may mean just simply being able to talk through these very kinds of things that we're discussing here and the sort of pressures that they may be feeling under the way that they're thinking about their singleness. Maybe it's just by creating more opportunities for them to be vitally connected to the Christian community of which they're a part, our families of which they have a role. For which they have a role. I'm so thankful for the many single people who have had very important connection with our families, single men who've had objectivity in my own life about who I am as a man that has affected my marriage. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for the single people who've come alongside our kids as they've grown up and provided an adult perspective outside the family that has been so good for them and for us as a family, and just being able to promote and to encourage the things that single people can in some ways sort of uniquely contribute to body life. I think there's also a place to help them look around. And to find, you know, places within the body of Christ where single folks can come together, where we can find people who may be a suitable match, I think that's good too. And to encourage that, because that's a good thing. And I think sometimes we shy away from that kind of stuff. And so if single folks may feel like maybe they're like, you know, a fifth wheel or something like that in your presence, that's really a drag. And we should draw them into that, and we should make that singleness both a virtue and a reality that we can talk about openly. So those are my thoughts on that in a practical way. There's more that could be said, and maybe you've got some thoughts about that we can talk towards the end about. Now I want to shift gears and talk about the second issue in this paragraph that Paul addresses. He says in verse 10, "But for those who are married, I have a command that comes not from me, but from the Lord. A wife must not leave her husband. But if she does leave him, let her remain single or else be reconciled to him. Likewise, a husband must not leave his wife." So this is a pretty radical teaching right here on a lot of levels. I want us to think about Paul's word to the married people. And the context is very important. He's talking about Christian couples within the framework of the Corinthian church. These are Christians, husband and wife, believers in Jesus Christ. And that's clear from what he talks about here. It's clear from the contrast that he brings in verse 12, where he says, "Now concerning the rest of the people," and now he talks about marriages between Christians and non-Christians, marriage among non-Christians, circumstances like that, things that we'll need to be talking about next week. But here he's talking specifically to committed Christians in the framework of that church, and he's saying to them, it's God's design and God's will for you to remain married. And he says, this is not my opinion. He says, this is the Lord's instruction. And almost certainly what Paul has in mind is the teaching of Christ in Matthew chapter 19. It parallels exactly the discussion that's going on in 1 Corinthians 7. And it goes like this, that some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" Well, that was a familiar position taken by most of the scribes of Jesus' day. And in Jewish writing that goes back to that era, you've got rabbis giving advice to husbands, saying if your wife is burning your dinner, if she's talking too loud so as to alert the neighbors to the distress of your marriage, if she's an embarrassment to you, divorce her. Just say, "I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you," and kick her out. And so these Pharisees are saying, "Jesus, what's your take on that?" And he says, well, you know, Moses in Deuteronomy 24 does allow you to divorce your wives because, he says, of the hardness of your heart. God is a realist. He understands the failings to love that result in divorce. And so he says, yes, it is true that Moses did allow divorce. That's right. But then he adds to this, and this is the important part. He says, "But whoever divorces his wife, except for reasons of immorality, and then marries another, commits adultery." And this is exactly what Paul really is describing here in 1 Corinthians 7. The issue here is people making decisions to flee a difficult marriage in search of an easier one. Okay, we got this problem in our marriage. My wife wants to pray all the time and she's not interested in sex. Well, I'm interested in sex, so we can't seem to resolve this problem, so I'm just going to divorce her and find somebody who will. And literally, that kind of thinking was going on in the Corinthian church. And Paul then invokes these teachings of Jesus to say, that's not God's way. Marriage is a permanent commitment between two people that you don't walk away from because it's hard. Because you've got this issue that you are unable to resolve right now. And so the idea of this isn't working, I'm out of it, I'm divorcing, I'm moving on to easier ground, it's divorce by preference. Divorce on demand, we call it in our own culture today. From the biblical point of view, it could be viewed as serial adultery. I marry this person, they're not who I thought they were, I divorce them and find this other person and marry them. I find out, they're not exactly who I thought they were either. I divorce them, I find somebody else. That's the moral equivalent, Paul and Jesus is saying, of adultery. And that's what he wants to avoid in this group. And so this brings up a fairly painful issue, it seems to me. The issue of divorce. And I am aware in raising this issue that a high percentage of us here tonight have been divorced. And divorce is a very intensely personal issue for us to talk about. Painful on many different levels. And so I just want to urge you, as we talk about these things and you think about your life, the life of people who maybe are close to you, that you prayerfully think about, you know, what is the Lord calling me to here to understand this very difficult issue? And what does it mean to find a place for grace in this context and the healing that he wants to bring to us? But we've got to be honest and we've got to talk about it. There are legitimate grounds for divorce in the scripture. It's very clear that infidelity is a cause for, is a reason for divorce, no doubt about it. But I don't know that that's the only reason. Certainly, the hardness of people's heart provides other reasons for divorce, and there are things such as criminal behavior that where a spouse is involved in something that's illegal, that's dangerous, and it's not a necessity that a spouse who's not involved in that continue under the dangerous circumstances of that kind of criminal activity. Absolutely. Or for reasons of abandonment or abuse. These are things that just are, even secular culture recognizes, they're so destructive that these are legitimate grounds for saying that the commitment of marriage has been violated in this case and divorce is appropriate. Now, these are areas, of course, of judgment. How much abuse? What kind of abuse? Things like that. That's why this whole 1 Corinthians 7 thing is shrouded in matters of discernment. And Paul is calling on us as a community to seek him out in these areas and to really think about and listen to one another as we talk about the marital difficulties and options that we are entertaining with respect to it. But it certainly is true, I guess is what I'm saying, and I think we as a church are agreed upon this, that there are legitimate grounds for divorce that are more than merely adultery or marital unfaithfulness. That said, it's important that we also, in thinking about this issue, engage the unavoidable pain that broken marriages bring. You know, a lot of us have been divorced, and many of us before we came to know Christ, and we were not Christians when we were married, and that marriage didn't work, and we became divorced, and how hard that has been for us. Again, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who are married to Christians, and what does it look like when things are really going south in that marriage, and we've got real problems, and divorce is something that's in our minds. What are we going to do about that? And one of the things that we're going to have to do is we're going to have to face the unavoidable pain of that broken marriage. We're going to have to look at that. That's the last thing that we want to do. We want to do what these people in Corinth were doing, which is fleeing. They were just saying, I'm out of here. It's over. I'm moving on. And Paul surely is calling people to stay in that relationship and to face the fact that there is a great pain in being wronged. You know, people are wronged and they don't want to face that they've been sinned against, that they've been violated in certain kinds of ways. They flee. And because that's unresolved, they end up in other relationships that repeat the same sort of deal. And it just sort of goes on like that. That's why second marriages fail twice as much as first marriages that fail half the time. That's why. And it's important for us to be able to honestly say, here in this marriage, with the dynamic that we have going on, has brought enormous pain into my life. And just to own that and to be honest about it. But also to own your own faults and say, I have been the inflictor of pain as well. That's right. And yes, my trust in my spouse has been violated by their actions. They're guilty. They really hurt me. But I also have a role to play in this marriage. And I also have been one who has inflicted more than my share of pain through judgment, through coldness, through whatever it might be, through my own self-righteousness in this marriage. And to be able to identify that, to own that fault, I have inflicted pain on the other. When we're in pain, we tend to think about, who do we think about when we're in pain? We think about myself, right? Like, oh, I'm in such pain. How are you doing today? You know, that's not where we're at. We're very concerned with self. And it's important that we also take ownership of where we are here. There is a painful legacy in the decision to divorce that affects children. And, you know, there is that mantra in our culture, well, for the sake of the kids. And I suppose in some cases where there are things going on that are illegal, that are just dangerous and abusive, that are criminal, things like that, yes, that you need to protect children, and divorce is perhaps necessary in that context. But most of the divorce that occurs is because I can't forgive you, because you've hurt me too much, because I don't trust you anymore, I'm tired of you, you bore me, somebody else is more intriguing, and I'm gone. And that thinking affects children. And I don't, there is unequivocal research, social research, to this end. And I didn't want to just drag in all the statistics because it's just, well, most of us know it. And you can go to Rutgers University and their website, and there's a whole thing on family, sociological studies there, and it just breaks all this stuff down. And I don't want to get into that, but I do want us to understand the truth and be reminded of the fact that children need to see healed relationships between their parents. And that's a value for us. And kids will carry on within their own lives into adulthood the scars that come through experiencing divorce. So those are some things that are unavoidable, painful things that relate to these decisions about divorce. But there's another decision about this that I want us to really get, and which is this decision, a costly decision to allow grace to produce reconciliation and real change in that marriage. And costly grace that allows reconciliation and real change to happen. You know, there are the pain of marriage, you know, marital failure is deep, and the scars, phew, are right in there. And if you have been sinned against in your marriage in a profound way, and that vulnerability that is necessary to make an intimate relationship work has been violated, then you know the deep pain that brings. But here is something that is a possibility uniquely to people indwelled by the Spirit of God, and which is this, that we have experienced the unmerited mercy of God ourselves through Jesus Christ. That we are sinners before a holy God, and that He demonstrated His great love for us by moving into our broken world and into our broken life, and as forgiveness must require he took upon himself the cost of our forgiveness. The cost of our forgiveness. Forgiveness can't happen without someone paying a price. Okay? If I forgive a debt, the debt doesn't just go away. I've taken that on. I've absorbed that debt myself. You see what I'm saying? All forgiveness requires a costly decision to embrace the offense, to pay for the offense in that sense. And we have an opportunity as those who have experienced the mercy of God to look at a guilty spouse and extend to them the same mercy and the same grace that God has extended to us. And we can be driven in an unreconciled way by the pain that a broken relationship, a broken marriage brings. Or we can submit our pain and the pain of our spouse to the cross of Jesus Christ, acknowledging that he took upon himself the burden of that debt. And that as one who has been forgiven, I have the capacity now to forgive as well, because my Lord has forgiven him or her. And that is a difficult decision, but it's the kind of decision that will absolutely affect the course of your life. And you come to those places in your marriage where you can decide not to forgive, and in one sense, that's your prerogative, okay? But you're not free with respect to the consequences, which are bitterness, which are alienation, which is a pervading sense of disconnection on an emotional level, on a deep personal level, from other people. And we're paying the price for that. We are. Or we can choose to extend this mercy and then begin to experience, yes, a painful process of realization about this marriage relationship. But we're also going to be able to learn, what does it mean for the mercy and the goodness, the grace of God to begin to take hold in the lives of each of us in this marriage relationship and begin to experience real transformation based upon now we've come to this place where together we just are pouring ourselves out before God. And we're saying, God, we want you to just show us where do we go from here. But we will move forward on the basis of your mercy, not holding these things over each other's heads, waiting to retaliate when they do something that reminds us of this thing from the past, but building in an honest way, rooted in his grace in the present. And that is possible. It is possible uniquely for believers in Jesus Christ and marriages among sinful, fallen people who are believers in Christ, of which we are all, is the most incredible triumph and demonstration of the reality of the grace of God there is. And many of us, I know, even here tonight, your lives and your marriages are beautiful trophies of God's mercy. And God has healed what you thought maybe at one point in your life was an unbearable pain, an unforgivable betrayal. And he has healed that and has strengthened you. And that is a beautiful thing. That's a powerful thing. Some of us here tonight have not yet met Jesus Christ in a personal way. We've not really experienced his forgiveness because we've not asked him for it. We know in some abstract way, yeah, I believe that God forgives. We've heard that before. But what do I do with that? Well, what we do with that is we approach God and we say to him in a personal way, Lord, I am guilty And I'm calling out to you for your forgiveness, knowing that the price of my forgiveness has been paid by your Son. And I want to receive that forgiveness into my life. And when we approach God like this, then we can say with the certainty of Scripture that God does forgive, absolutely. And we have an ability that we have not had before. And we can begin to look at these broken relationships in our lives, our broken marriages. And there is hope. And there is hope. And God does change life. So that's a part of the decision-making process here with this whole issue of divorce. And lastly, I just would want to say, and we're going to kind of continue this discussion into next week. We're going to talk about, well, what if my spouse is not even a Christian? Or things that are like that. Namely, maybe they said they're a Christian. There's nothing about them that's spiritual. Where do I go with that? Well, we're going to talk about that next time. But I also want us to think about the fact that many of us maybe are tempted to live. We're committed to our marriage because we know it's the right thing to do. But in our hearts, we're kind of done. We're tired of being hurt. We're tired of being, well, whatever it is. And so we live as divorced. And we are really just cutting ourselves off from emotionally from that, from our spouse. We want to remove ourselves from the possibility of being hurt. And so we need to ask ourselves, you know, as I have drifted away from my spouse and we have this comfortably numb parallel life going, you've just sort of drawn our thing. What am I avoiding here? I'm avoiding getting hurt, but maybe I'm avoiding some other things too. Maybe I'm avoiding making that decision to forgive. Maybe I'm avoiding tearing up that list of memories of that spouse's failure against me and treating them with the same mercy that God treated me. And in that sense, we're dealing with an inner hypocrisy in our own hearts. I want to experience the forgiveness of God, but I refuse to forgive the most intimate person in my life. And so that's something we need to think about. What pain am I avoiding in this distant marriage that I'm experiencing? How am I protecting my pride? You know, I'm going to hold my breath and fold my arms till when? Well, either I pass out or they apologize, you know. And, you know, we're collapsing on the floor all the time. And you and I have no idea the incredible extent of our own pride, the demands that we put on others to love us the way we so richly deserve, right? That's a problem. We need to ask ourselves, am I seeking solutions or have I given up? And here, I just want to say in closing, there's something really super beautiful about marriage in the context of the Christian community. Real relationships. And I think it was Dave last week made this point. You know, when we have people in our lives who are able to be objective about what they see in our marriages, the problems that they're seeing, stuff like that, and are able to call us out and say, I understand you are in pain, but what are you doing about that? What are you doing about that, brother? You know, that is very important because we do have the tools of a broader body that if we're serious about protecting the integrity of our marriages and want to experience through them all that God has for us, we've got a community of people around who are able to provide for us that kind of support, that kind of input. We, you know, to go along with the with our world's view of marriage as this isolated bubble, and no one knows what goes on in our household but us. You know, really? You know, if you're living in this hermetically sealed bubble, you are going to suffocate. And it's only when our lives are open before other people that we really are able to begin to experience the goodness of God and the transforming power of his work in our lives. And so those are just some thoughts here, again, on marriage within the Christian community, between believers. This is what Paul says. And boy, I just feel like this is really one of those really important areas where our attentiveness to these issues is either going to catalyze us into a real victorious experience of God in our life, or is just going to completely take us out. And so it's worth really thinking about this together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.